You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Franklin Delano Roosevelt came into office in 1932, America faced an economic crisis. His New Deal policies have been credited with not only helping to pull the country out of the Great Depression, but also of setting the stage for decades of growth and prosperity. In his latest book, I think it's somewhere around his 20th, economist and New York Times op-ed columnist Paul Krugman describes what's happened since the end of the New Deal. It's called The Conscience of a Liberal, published by Norton, and I'm pleased that it has brought Professor Krugman back to the show today. Hello.
Hi there.
You point out that FDR was a partisan politician, that the very wealthy hated him, but that he welcomed their hatred, which is odd because he came out of their class, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. He was. They hated him especially because he was a traitor to their class. And he was. You know, really, 98% of the American population was left much better off by the New Deal. But at the very top, incomes really did decline because of progressive taxation, unions, and all the things that FDR brought in.
And there's all that polarization that people decry today. Politicians seem to need to promote bipartisan cooperation. Do you think that that is a mistake?
It is a mistake when you don't have the basis for it. What happened, and one of the things I learned in writing Conscience of a Liberal, is that the bipartisanship that some people look back on, the center, that came basically when, after World War II, Republicans decided for a while to accept the New Deal, to basically say, okay, Social Security isn't going away. We're not going to go back to the way it was in the Gilded Age. And so we had several decades when there really was some common ground between the parties. We don't have that common ground right now, so I don't think until we get it back, bipartisanship is meaningless.
Economists often argue that institutions don't play that large a role in the economy. How can you be sure that it's the institutions that have made the difference for income disparity and not the markets?
Well, there's two pieces of evidence, really. One is history. The middle-class society of the post-war generation, the society I grew up in, didn't evolve gradually. You can just look at the history of it, and it was created in a very short period of time. Basically, in 1937, we were still living in the Gilded Age. By 1945, we were the middle class. We were the America of Ozzie and Harriet. And that happened because of the policies of FDR, the policies of the New Deal. And the other thing is, internationally, this increase, this polarization of economic polarization that we have here in this country is unique to the United States. It's only us. And that's telling you that it's not something that globalization brings or technology brings. It's something that only happens when you have a U.S.-type political environment.
But didn't the New Deal policies take a while to kick in? Some historians credit the buildup to World War II as having been as important to turning things around as FDR's economic policies.
Oh, sure. No, the recovery from the Great Depression was largely owing to a very large public works program, otherwise known as World War II, which just kicked up the demand. But we could have had a recovery that still left society as unequal as it had been in the 1920s. We could have just gone back to the Great Gatsby. We didn't because it was FDR. We emerged as a truly middle-class society.
And you say greater income equality is better for our democracy?
Sure. When you have—
Why does it matter?
Because there are really two things. One is when you have enormous disparities of income, we just aren't a common society. People are not living in the same material universe. They don't, you know, you start going towards a Brazil-type situation where the elite flies in helicopters across the slums and just isn't part of the society. And in fact, malefactors of great wealth do distort the political process. So you can see it that when we have this much disparity, I'm not saying we should have, you know, Cuba, when we have this much disparity, democracy as a no longer functions properly. Essentially, money corrupts.
When the unions were at their peak, they also played a role in reducing income disparity, didn't they? Why has that ended?
Okay, yeah. Unions do a lot to reduce income disparity, both directly through the wages they get through for their members and by being a countervailing force. By against the money of big business, which will always be there, you have the membership of the unions, which is large in number and organized. It's countervailing weight in all kinds of things. The decline in unions in the U.S. is U.S. specific. I mean, Canada and the U.S. had the same fraction of their workers in unions in the 1960s. Canada still has the same fraction of its workers in unions that it did in the 1960s. Here, the union movement has largely collapsed. And it's because of politics. It's because of union busting, which was corporations were able to do because the government looked on it favorably.
Didn't unions also help workers who didn't have union jobs because they raised the
very much so.
Wage rates for everybody?
Sure. I mean, the wage rate, even in the 1950s, even non-union companies had to pay pretty close to union wages in order not to have a union.
But didn't FDR's government impose wage controls during World War II?
Indeed, they did.
That was a form of union controlling, if not busting.
Oh, it wasn't union busting. In fact, what they did in the wage controls, the way they were administered, had the effect of raising the lowest wages much more than the highest wages, of compressing the wage differentials, economies there, but making the differences, the spread of incomes narrower. And the amazing thing is it stuck. If you think that it's all supply and demand, that politics, sociology has nothing to do with this, you have to explain why what the historians call the Great Compression of incomes that took place during World War II actually set the norms for our society for 30 years after World War II.
You said that for a while the Republicans accepted the New Deal. When did they start to push back?
Well, it's a gradual process. There was always a core of people, starting with people like William Buckley and the National Review, who were against it. Goldwater was the first sort of national Republican politician to really turn against it. He was pushed back. I mean, he lost the election, and the moderate Republicans regained control of the party for a while, but this movement building in the 60s, Reagan and so on, and in the course of the 1970s, what I call movement conservatism, actually it's what the movement conservatives call movement conservatism, took over the Republican Party.
And some people, in fact, there was a book written about how the Goldwater campaign really mobilized a whole bunch of people, and even though that was a disaster for them, it led to all the changes in the way the conservatives have worked and put together all these new programs and gotten think tanks together and the like.
You read the speech that made Reagan a national figure, his speech in 1964 for Goldwater, A Time for Choosing. It's got everything that has happened since sort of hidden, not so hidden. I keep on looking for a more normal word than imminent, but anyway, it's all in there. Everything from the harshness, making fun of people who don't have enough to eat, saying, oh, they're all probably on a diet, to the fuzzy math, to the rhetoric about welfare cheats and so on that did so much to eventually win Republicans big victories.
My guest is Paul Krugman, whose latest book is called The Conscience of a Liberal. It's published by Norton, obviously, a variant on Barry Goldwater's famous title, The Conscience of a Conservative. We had a new deal with LBJ in his Great Society and War on Poverty programs. Tom Wicker has said that Richard Nixon was the last of the liberal presidents.
Yes.
So why we had a Democrat and a Republican really pushing to promote some of these programs for different reasons, perhaps, but then the whole thing falls apart. Is it that they pushed too far?
No, it's not. If you actually look, it's not that there were really big problems with the programs. That's a myth that we've made up later. If you ask why did the political tide turn, it was, first of all, this movement, this cohesive set of overlapping institutions, ultimately backed by money, took over the Republican Party, and it started winning elections because of just five words. Southern whites started voting Republican. It was the backlash against the civil rights movement as consequences. That's the whole story.
That was Nixon's Southern strategy.
Nixon's, but it's there in Goldwater already. It's there in Reagan's first debut. I mean, Reagan ran for governor of California, partly on a promise to repeal the Fair Housing Act.
So are you saying that the conservative movement is built on racism?
It's funny. It's not dedicated to racism. The people running the stuff, I don't think, care much. What they're interested in is economics, but it has won elections based on racism. Ronald Reagan began his 1980 campaign by going to Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the civil rights workers were murdered, and giving a speech about the importance of respecting states' rights. Everybody knew what he was talking about.
So the people were speaking in a kind of a coded way.
Yeah.
But that still would suggest that you're saying that racism is, whether these people saw themselves as racist or not, racism is one of the factors.
Oh, sure. There's a quote I can't reproduce exactly, but from Lee Atwater explaining his strategy, saying, well, back in the 60s, you would go and say nigger, 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 and now you just say things about states' rights and low taxes, but it's, you're appealing to the same people.
And yet we don't hear as much about the role that race has played in politics since the 1970s.
Well, people prefer, you know, we've whitewashed what Reagan was. I mean, Reagan has become the great pure conservative advocate, but he's in fact the guy who went around making up stories about welfare queens driving Cadillacs. And, you know, we pretended. And the other thing is that it is a diminishing force. I mean, this is an optimistic book, The Conscience of a Liberal, because I think that the strategies that they've used for the past 30 years are now losing their effectiveness.
But there have been a number of people going all the way back to Henry Adams who say that America goes through these cycles, 30-year cycles. I think Adams said 36-year cycles, that which would suggest that after we went through a long liberal period, we went through a long conservative period. Now we're going to go back into a liberal period, perhaps.
You know, I don't know. That's too automatic, mechanical. We're talking about what motivates people to take positions, what motivates them to vote. And, you know, the public never bought into, you know, the public never cared all that much about tax cuts. The public never bought into supply-side economics. There were other things that let the right-wing win elections. And it's not, you know, that's not the story. People never were really into the conservative agenda, though they are more liberal now than they were, much more than they were 20 years ago.
How did movement conservatism take over the Republican Party?
Well, a lot of it is money. There's, you know, what some of my friends call wingnut welfare. If you're a loyal movement conservative and things go wrong in your political career, there's this a safety net waiting for you. If you're a Rick Santorum and you get humiliatingly defeated, you've got a job waiting for you at a think tank where you head the new America's Enemies program. So there's a lot of influence there. And then cohesive think tanks provide ideas. Media networks like Fox News give you a platform. It's just a whole set of things that create a tremendous incentive to go along with the movement.
Is it a good thing that the Democrats have tried to emulate some of the more successful aspects of the Republicans' operations, like think tanks and a different kind of relationship with lobbyists, for example?
Oh, sure. I mean, you got to play hardball. You know, don't bring a knife to a gunfight. You got to play hardball politics. And now there is a real progressive movement in the way there wasn't 10 years ago. It's very different. It's not, you know, the movement conservatism is top down. The progressive movement we now have isn't the same way. I always think all the stuff about George Soros, you know, it's partly conspiracy theorizing, it's partly hidden anti-Semitism, but it's also that their idea that George Soros must be running everything, well, that's the way their movement works, not ours.
Do you think race is still an effective way to appeal to white Southern voters in 2007, for example, or do you think that maybe conservatives have become more tolerant, looking at Rudy Giuliani's campaign despite his marital history, his moderate stances on gay marriage and abortion? He seems to be doing better in the polls than anyone had anticipated.
Ah, but you know, that actually makes sense. Giuliani is, on the moral values issues, if that was really decisive, Giuliani would be a big problem. He's been tolerant of gays. He's even worn a dress, you know, all this stuff. But he does come across and has a history of being somebody who cracks down on you-know-who. So that actually fits the story. It still plays a role. The South is, if you look at the 2006 elections, Southern whites are the only major demographic group that went heavily Republican. But it's a diminishing role, and it's losing its force. And, you know, Virginia, I thought the Makaka moment was actually the defining moment of what's happening to America.
Do you think immigration has replaced race as a potential point to rally conservatives?
Immigration is the same thing as race. It's the other. The people who are anti-immigrant, the profile of the part of the Republican base that's furiously anti-immigrant is the same as the profile of the people who voted basically on racial lines. It's the same thing, and it's why the Republicans have a problem.
On the other hand, some immigrants, when they became voters, wound up voting for the Republicans.
Only for a little while. I mean, that was interesting. As it became clear where the Republican base settled, you know, so Latinos were voting Republican a bit, especially Cuban Latinos, but not anymore. You can just see. It's now the Republican base which is really still what's left of it, its shrinking base, is still heavily racialist in its views. And immigrants and descendants of immigrants see that. And that's why the Republican Party is now in such deep trouble.
My guest is Paul Krugman. His latest book, The Conscience of a Liberal, published by Norton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we're back with Paul Krugman, whose latest book is The Conscience of a Liberal, published by Norton. The early books, mostly of a technical sort. You almost slipped into economist ease at some point there before.
Yeah, sorry about that.
And then you started thinking about explaining these things to a wider audience?
I was doing this broader audience writing for fun, mostly. I was writing, so I had a monthly column at Slate, and then added another one at Fortune, and then the Times was looking for somebody who could write about economics and also write it in English, which is a fairly small set, so there I am.
And interestingly, it grew into as much a political column as an economist column, and maybe that's because we can't separate the two.
Well, it's also the times we live in. I mean, it's... If it turned out to be the world I thought I was going to be writing in when I signed up with the Times, I'd be writing a lot about international finance and so on. And once in a while, I do write about those things, but I usually get a barrage of email from loyal readers who say, "We're not interested. Go back to talking about what's happening here." And that's the kind of world we're in.
You point out in your book that Democrats were the party of ideas in 1932, and that idea was the New Deal. Did the reverse happen with the Republican Party in the 1980s?
Well, you know, it's the famous Moynihan quote that the Republicans have become the party of ideas, and they certainly had ideas, although not very deep ones, but they certainly did have something. But I think that plays much less role than people like to, you know, the story that people tell is the Republicans won because they had this idea about smaller government to supply economics, but it's not actually how they won elections.
But they seem to have a plan, and Newt Gingrich sold that to the American public.
Yeah, well, but that was nothing in there, right? The contract on America, as some of my friends call it, had very little substance to it. One of the messages is now, you know, in 2000, they got control of all three branches of the U.S. government, and they got a chance to show what they could do running everything, and boy. They're a lot better as an opposition party.
What about the way economists see these things? You talk about a growing disparity, but some economists say that there really hasn't been any change in inequality.
I have no idea who these economists are. There are some people writing things saying that, but no, there's absolutely zero doubt that there's been a huge increase in disparities.
Why don't corporate executives' high salaries receive the negative press that they used to?
A lot of that is because we don't have – a lot of that comes back to the lack of a union movement. I mean, we don't have an effective voice. Some people have pointed out major newspapers used to have some reporter covering the labor beat. They don't now. You just don't get that. And you know, it's coming. You actually look at the polls and people are getting upset about these disparities.
Well, when there are these contentious union negotiations, the unions often point out that the top executives, even though they're saying, well, sales are down or we're losing money, the top executives got bonuses on top of bonuses, but that never seems to have much of an impact.
Well, you know, things may be changing, but sure, we got into this acceptance, which comes out of a whole, you know, we got into a mood where, as people used to say, actually, as the people who are executives, the experts on executive compensation say, what used to limit executive salaries was the outrage constraint. And the outrage constraint got pretty much done away with through all kinds of things, media attention, lack of effective unions, political environment, and I think it's coming back.
Well, why haven't countries like Japan and Great Britain had the same runaway executive salaries that we have in the United States?
Because they still have an outrage constraint. Because they don't have they still have important other players. British unions are a lot weaker than they were in the 1970s, but they're still vastly stronger than ours. No government in the advanced world is as uninterested in income disparities as ours is.
And to some degree, do you think that's because we have change the tax code, allowing the super rich to keep a lot more of their money?
Well, there's some of that. To when, you know, back in the days of when we had socialists like Dwight Eisenhower running the government, corporate, you know, the top tax rate on individuals was 91%, which I'm not advocating. There wasn't much.
But they could get around a lot of that.
Nobody paid 91%. But, you know, but still, when there were high tax rates, it was not worth so much to try and extract. And there's actually economic literature that studies this, and the lower marginal tax rates are part of the reason for the salary explosion, because it just became worth cutting corners in order to get your board to vote you a huge paycheck because you could keep more of it.
Hasn't there been an economic recovery in the last few years?
Yeah.
So why hasn't that helped the situation for most Americans?
Well, it's a very lopsided economic recovery. It's an economic recovery where corporate profits have doubled, but real wages of the typical worker have basically gone nowhere. And that, in turn, I think, comes back to the lack of bargaining power on the part of ordinary workers. It's just a remarkable thing. But, yeah, it's actually awesome how we've had, by the numbers, it's a respectable, not great, but respectable recovery, but none of it trickled down.
Well, today's New York Times reported that Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson may be more worried about the economy than he's let on. Is that a sign that we're headed for another economic downturn?
You know, short-term economic forecasting, nobody does that too well. Not me, not anybody else. And they're worried, as they should be. The housing bust is huge, and it has collateral damage to the financial markets because of the subprime mess and all of that. They're worried, as they should be. They're worried a little bit too late. I mean, 6 months ago, I could have told them that we had some serious problems. But, yeah, it is interesting to see, you know, we're all against government intervention and bailouts if it means, you know, helping sick children. But if the banks are in need of help, now we've got some action.
I do want to talk about SCHIP a little later, but let's talk about globalization for a second. Has it been a contributor to this inequality we've been talking about?
Yes. I mean, you know.
Weren't you a strong supporter of globalization?
And I still
years
am.
Ago?
But not for the reasons that I think some people are. I'm a strong supporter of globalization because it's the only hope for very poor countries. I'm a globalization advocate for the sake of Bangladesh. Its impact on the U.S. economy, it does exacerbate inequality. We've always known that. The numbers are probably a bit bigger than they were when I was last talking about this a lot a decade ago because of the rise of China. Very low-wage country, huge factor in trade. But we know it's not the decisive factor in growing inequality. And the way we know that is that every other advanced country is facing the same global environment as we are, but we're unique in the explosion of inequality.
Well, how can we balance free trade with providing jobs, especially production jobs, for American workers when we're exporting them?
Well, but there are lots of jobs that we aren't exporting, and the important thing is to make sure that jobs that we do have pay well. There's nothing that says that service sector jobs have to be low wage, low paid. If you just didn't know the facts, you would have said that Walmart is a perfect candidate for unionization and a strong, you know, it doesn't face international competition. It's a giant corporation. It's our biggest employer now. Why shouldn't it have a powerful union? The only reason is that Walmart grew to its preeminence in an environment in which union busting was basically given full sanction by Washington. There are lots of things you can do. There's no reason why workers should be losing health care coverage, because in every other advanced country, society provides health care insurance to everybody. So these negative things that we attribute to globalization are actually consequences of our particularly brutal system. And I wrote Conscience of a Liberal because I think we can change that.
And you feel that universal health care should be the focus of any new deal?
Yeah, it's the definite starting point. The thing about universal health care is we know it's doable. Every other advanced country has it. In fact, every other advanced country has universal health care at lower cost than our system. And so you can do a huge good thing at essentially negative cost for the population. And it's also, it's a proving. It's a pilot project. It's a demonstration of concept that society can, in fact, help people make their lives more secure, which then I think would be a step towards doing some other things, a number of other smaller things that would help to make us a less unequal, less brutal society.
But when people suggest changes in our healthcare approach, we hear politicians saying this is just an example of creeping socialism.
Yeah.
Does the ongoing debate on expanding S-CHIP echo the larger healthcare debate?
Of course it does. S-CHIP, it happens to be a perfect one because the right saying it's socialized medicine, and the American public is saying if that's socialized medicine, let's have it. I mean, we already have. Actually, most health insurance in the United States is already socialized, if that's the word you want to use. Medicare and Medicaid pay more bills than private insurance companies do already in the United States.
So then why do so many conservatives say that we don't want to have in fact, Republicans called S-CHIP the first step towards socialized medicine. Are they just ignoring the fact that Medicare and Medicaid are a form of socialized medicine?
No, they just don't want more. They don't want the principle that we are our brother's keepers. They don't want the idea that society has a responsibility to take care of people to prevent avoidable risks, because that leads to higher taxes on rich people in the end. They were able to play on the fact that most people don't draw the parallels. I mean, there's the famous case of Senator John Breaux being chased through the airport by a constituent who said, "Senator, don't let the government get its hands on Medicare." Right? People don't understand that the programs that everyone loves are in fact what the Republicans are calling socialized medicine.
In your column on Friday, you wrote about the Republican effort to discredit Graham Frost, the 12-year-old boy who Democrats found had been helped by S-CHIP. Why did they think their attack would be effective?
Largely because they've been very effective at this sort of thing in the past. The smear tactics just have worked very well for their party. They haven't been called on bad, not doing their homework before. There's so many times that there have been false anecdotes. I mean, right now, every time Bush speaks against S-CHIP expansion, he says this law would provide insurance for people earning up to $83,000 a year. That's a flat lie. There's nothing like that in the bill. But how many news reports have you seen saying that he lied about that? So why would they think that they would get in trouble? But the problem is they actually overreached and they got caught.
Well, whose fault is that? Is it newspapers' fault? Because I'm sure you're not the only person who knows something about economics at the New York Times. I'm sure the Washington Post has a couple of people, the LA Times, et cetera, the Associated Press. Why aren't more people crunching those numbers?
A lot of it is the conventions of journalism, which have worked very much to the advantage of the bad guys. Back in the 2000 campaign, just when I was starting, I couldn't believe with what Bush was getting away with on the campaign trail. He was saying things that were just flatly untrue. And the newspaper reports either didn't point that out at all or simply said, well, some Democrats suggest that what Bush is saying is not true. And I actually wrote a column 7 years ago where I said that if Bush said that the Earth was flat, the headline would read, "Opinions Differ on Shape of Planet." I mean, it's a terrible thing, and it's a real disservice to readers.
Do you think you called it a smear campaign against S-CHIP? Would you call the fact that more Democrats now call themselves progressives than liberals the result of a smear campaign?
Yeah, there's been this huge demonizing of liberals.
Is it the same thing to call yourself a progressive or a liberal?
In my mind, there liberal is your general outlook, and progressive is being part of a political movement trying to put that outlook into effect. So I would say that you can be a liberal but not a progressive, in which case you're basically not doing anything about your beliefs. I don't think you can be a progressive without basically having liberal values. But look, if you ask people, are you a liberal or are you a conservative, twice as many people say conservative. If you ask them, do you think the government should guarantee health insurance to everyone, twice as many say yes as no. So people actually are liberals, but they don't think they're liberals. And One way to deal with that is to try and avoid the label, but I think that's, I don't blame people for doing it, but it's not the way I'm going to do it.
Do you think the 2006 elections were a signal that movement conservatism is losing its clout, or is it just the weakness of the people who are now being made available? Because when you look at the people who are running for president right now, nobody really stands out as a giant among men.
In the Republican Party,
it is pretty much men.
If Bush was actually a pretty very weak candidate, if we'd gotten some accurate reporting. No, I think it is. I mean, I think that 2002 and 2004 were the aberrations. That was when they were able to distract us, to convince the people that only the Republicans would protect us against gay married terrorists. But that wasn't going to last. And 2006 looks more like the way the country is actually going.
Don't some people say that if there's a way that the Democrats can blow it, they'll find that way?
You know, and there's always some of that. But the truth is, a lot of the Democrat bashing, ridiculing, is missing the point that there were a lot of reasons why the right was managing to exploit hot button issues. And I don't think that the Democrats are in that bad shape now.
But looking at you talking about universal health care, are any of the Democrats really suggesting universal health care? And isn't the change in the Democratic Party, that dependence on lobbyists, also an important factor in what they come up with? Michael Moore's movie Sicko revealed that even Hillary Rodham Clinton has taken money from health care industry lobbyists.
And by the way, that turns out to be a piece of really bad reporting. Because what they've done, I mean, certainly she's gotten money from healthcare industry lobbyists, but the numbers you hear mixed together, the actual industry packs with just individuals who give money. So if a doctor who sincerely is a sincere progressive gives money to Hillary Clinton, that's being counted in those numbers. This is a bad number. This is a really bad. And in terms of, sure, the Democrats are affected. There's lots of stuff to disturb you about that. But the healthcare plans being offered by the Democrats are not my ideal. My ideal would be Medicare for everyone, but they're pretty good. John Edwards came out with a really very good, doable, politically possible plan in February, and the other two leading candidates have emulated that plan. And this is, 2 years ago, that would have been unthinkable. So this is actually a tremendous step in the right direction.
My guest is Paul Krugman. His latest book, The Conscience of a Liberal, is published by Norton. What do you think about the Republican candidates' health care plans? John McCain wants to bring down costs through performance-based evaluations. Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements would also be performance-based. Mitt Romney's plan seems to be a state-by-state approach. Rudolph Giuliani advocates moving from employer-based benefits to individually bought benefits.
Yeah, they're all basically around this idea that fundamentally, they're all based on the idea that the problem with American healthcare is that people have too much insurance, and so they consume too much medical care, which is not right. It's just not the way the real problem with the system. I want Mitt Romney back. The governor of Massachusetts, who signed a pretty reasonable, not great but reasonable plan, has obviously been abducted and replaced with an evil clone.
What do you think Hillary Clinton did wrong or Bill Clinton did wrong in 1993 with their health plan?
It's a whole list of things. They tried to do two. They tied their health care plan, at least the selling of it, very much to the HMO idea, which was big at the time, and that scared people. And they really should have just said universal care is the first priority.
And they did the HMOs because they were afraid of attacks from the right?
No, because at the time, everyone, the conventional wisdom was that was the great solution to medical cost problems. Misconceived idea. And above all, they moved too slowly. The contrast. Lyndon Johnson signed Medicare at the end of July 1965. Bill Clinton didn't give his first major speech on health care until September 1993. And also the times were not right. I mean, the trends were not there. The health care situation improved somewhat spontaneously even as they were trying to get this thing through. That is not going to happen this time. So I think the chances are just much better that a Democrat, if he or she is sufficiently determined, can get us universal health care in the very near future.
What else do you think that Democrats should aim to do beyond universal health care?
At that point, it becomes a list of smaller things. Expanded earned income tax credit, higher minimum wages beyond what we're getting in the bill that was pushed through.
They just got a new increased minimum wage over a lot of dead bodies.
Yeah, but it's going to – we hope that after the next election, things will look different than, and we're still this minimum wage increase just returns it in inflation adjusted terms back to what it was in 1967.
One analyst points out that the new Democrats who are in Congress and the ones who are likely to join Congress are from relatively conservative districts, people who have just become a little disillusioned with their longtime Republican representatives, which would mean that those Democrats would have to not be as liberal as some of the things that you are suggesting. There are even Democrats in one state. Isn't there a guy who's running to the right of the Republican?
Yeah, but that's I've looked at that. And if you look, the Democrats, the freshman members are tiny, fractions to the right of the middle of the party, but every Democrat in Congress is to the left of every Republican in Congress. So the Democratic takeover is a huge shift to the left in the political center.
Stephen Colbert, the host of the Colbert Show, or Colbert Report, has challenged you to eat a cricket if sales of his new book, I Am America, and So Can You, top sales of your book. Have you accepted that challenge?
I have not, although we've laid in a store of chocolate crickets just in case. But his book is funny. Mine, I think, might be interesting, but it's not funny. So I don't think it's really a fair challenge.
Maureen Dowd wrote that he was threatening to shave you with a broken bottle while he was guest writing her column on this past Sunday.
He's just mad at me because I actually pulled off an ad-lib one-liner on his show. And that's the
you mean you were
not,
funnier than he was?
Yeah,
for
about 30 seconds. And
what
that's
was
not
that?
Supposed to happen. Oh, he was talking. It's a long story, but I managed to talk about being linked to Jay-Z. And anyway, never mind.
Meanwhile, we will continue our conversation and get into some of these things in even more depth tomorrow night at 8 o'clock at the 92nd Street Y. I really look forward to that. On Friday, October 26th, Paul Krugman will be at the Union Square Barnes & Noble store. That's at 7 o'clock for a talk and a signing. And there may still be tickets to the Times Talk event this Friday. For details, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. The book, The Conscience of a Liberal, is published by Norton. And as usual, it's been great talking with you.
It's great to be on.